is Kelly Lally, and I'm here in Louisville, Kentucky with Mr. James Ashby. Today is August the
19th, 1987. Yeah.
When were you born, Mr. Ashby?
Central City, Kentucky, in Muhlenberg County, coal mining country, West Kentucky coal mining country.
In what year?
Oh, 1915. Uh-huh. Most people don't realize we have two coal fields in Kentucky, and that's why I said the West Kentucky, or that's part of the Illinois coal field in Western Kentucky. Mm-hmm. The Eastern Kentucky is the Appalachian field, which is a much larger coal field and better grade of coal than we had.
Tell me a little bit about your family.
Oh, gosh, well, my family all of them were born in Kentucky. I come from a long line of, I came from hardy pioneer stock. I don't know when my people came over. They may have come over on the Mayflower, but I had some that were in the Civil War. My grandmother was born in Kentucky around Calhoun, Livermore area. There, I forget what county that's in, but that's down in the Green River area, which is not too far from Muhlenberg County. In fact, Green River is part of the border between Muhlenberg County and Ohio County there. Mm-hmm. I heard that my grandfather Ashby came from Illinois, but I don't remember exactly. I don't know whether he was born in Kentucky or not. My paternal grandmother her people came from Virginia, and she always said that she was related to the Lees of Virginia. I have a brother named Raymond Lee, had an uncle named Jesse Lee, mm-hmm. her youngest son, and she said that Ben Lee was her uncle, and I think Robert E. Lee was supposed to have been his uncle.
Oh, so, you
had
a connection.
My mother's people came from around the, they were all native born Kentuckians too, farmers. All my mother's people, her maiden name was Grimes. Mm-hmm. And she came from Warren County, around Bowling Green area there, where you are. They were all, a lot of farmers, a lot of her relatives still live there, the Grimeses. They were all ignorant farmers. A lot of them couldn't read or write, you know, back then. That was not too uncommon, illiteracy back when I was growing up. The same way in Muhlenberg County there, I tell everyone that I grew up in a sea of ignorance and poverty, and it was. A lot of times people think that I'm bragging when I tell them that the average person now doesn't know what real poverty is like. Because back then people went hungry. You didn't have all this government stuff, which I don't believe in too much, only to a certain extent. I don't think people need it now. But people had to get out and hustle and to keep from starving to death and raise gardens, and a lot of people would fish. And I used to do a lot of fishing, and black people a lot of times, and white people too for that matter, would catch those little bitty sunfish, you know, about that long, and cut their heads off and fry the whole thing and eat the bones and all. They fry them real good and eat the bones and all. A lot of people eat crawfish, crawfish tails. And if we hadn't lived on a farm, I guess we would have starved to death. But it was, Muhlenberg County back then was a beautiful place. There must have been a lot of Indians there, because you could find arrowheads and Indian relics all over the place, and it was all forested. It was hilly. Most of it wasn't too good for farming country, but it was a beautiful place when I was a child. The streams were clear and pure, and almost every hillside in the woods would have a cold spring water running out. And there at Drakesburg, Kentucky, Muhlenberg County, there was a big spring out at the edge of town there, and I remember when I was a child, they had a big horse cult there. And that thing ran the year around. It was so cold and pure. Now it's all gone. The farmers would haul water from there by the barrel, by the drum. It was forested, beautiful forest, all kinds of game and fish and wildlife. The coal mines moved in. First it was the deep shaft mines and what we call the slope mines, which would go back in the hill. Or some people called them drift mines, and would go back in the hill, sort of downhill, into a hillside back then. And although they weren't stripping too much at that time, there was a few around, but most of them, the coal was too deep back then, and they didn't have the technology that they have now, and the giant machines to remove the earth over the top, and a lot of them went broke and closed down. But they pumped that, what we called it copper water then, they call it sulfur water now. That copper water out of the mines, and that got into all the streams and the lakes and everything, just killed everything. It even killed the trees. Even the crawfish couldn't live in the stream. Pond Creek was about a mile from Drexburg down the railroad track, and there's a water tank. Of course, back then they had steam locomotives. There's a water tank there right by the creek, and they pumped water from the creek back then into the water tank because it was so pure. And it was such a beautiful creek. It was just full of fish, water lilies and flowers and giant trees. I remember right near the railroad trestle there was a huge stump where a huge sycamore tree had been cut down, and it was big enough to dance on the stump. It was about 6 feet. Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh, you couldn't reach across it like that. And everyone said that people used to dance on that, you know. But it was a beautiful country. And the coal mines back in the 20s, now in the roaring 20s that was something else during Prohibition. Drexburg was a wild town. Most towns around there were. It was a coal mining camp, about 1,200 at its peak population. And of course, coal miners led a hard, dangerous life back then. I don't know if you've heard Merle Travis's song, you know, 16 tons, and what do you mm-hmm. get? Another day older and deeper in debt, and that's mm-hmm. so true. And that's, St. Peter, when you call me, I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. And that's very true. The guy who worked, you know, they would draw, they had checks. You could go to the company store and draw on your wages, and had these what's called flickers and denomination, 25, 10, 25, a dollar checks. And they would go there and draw those things out on their wages. And a lot of times they might need money, and they would sell them for about 60 or 65 cents on the dollar to get cash. And of course, that was their wages, you know.
Yeah.
So that was cutting down on what they got paid. And you didn't have too many machines back then in the mines. People nowadays talk about women, you know, doing things that men could do. They couldn't have done it. they couldn't have loaded coal, stooped over all day with a number three coal scoop. They couldn't have done it. With modern technology, women can do a lot of things that men do now that, you know, that they couldn't have done then. And I think the whole thing's kind of silly to say that men and women are the same. I just don't believe that at all. I'm sort of a dinosaur. mentally, yes, but physically, no.
Well, what were times like for your family during the Depression, and how many kids were in your family?
There was, I was telling you about the Roaring Twenties. Drexburg was, after World War One, you know, it was sort of after World War Two, you know, things really picked up, and there was booming. And I remember my daddy back then, when I was real young, I think we only had about two or three children then, and he was paying $14 for a silk shirt, you know, those wild, striped silk shirts back then, which didn't have nylon and all that stuff. And that was during Prohibition, of course, and there was bootleggers all over town, and on Saturday night, boy, I'm telling you, it was wild. Shootouts in the streets, and I've seen a lot of people get shot there. They had one policeman there, and he carried a big nickel-plated 45. His name was Ed Sampson. I think he was a cousin to my paternal grandmother, and wore a great, he was red, had red hair, and had a huge red mustache. And boy, he was rough. He had been shot several times himself, but he would just soon shoot you as look at you. I've seen him shoot at people with that 45, just shooting over the top of them, you know, and shooting right into houses and things. You know, it's a wonder he hadn't killed someone. And a lot of them were shot down on the streets. Well, then of course I remember when Prohibition was repealed and how wild that was. That was in 1933, I think. It was after Roosevelt was elected the first time. And it was really wild then. My daddy used to work for help out in Ellie Kelly's pool room downtown. That was one of the main entertainment centers downtown. They had four or five pool tables. And I remember they had a big Crosley radio. This was in the late 20s or so. It was big in a big metal cabinet and had the speaker that set up on top. And we boys, of course, there was no place to go back then. We didn't have any money to go anywhere anyway. And people didn't have cars like they do now, young people especially. I never owned a car until I was 49 years old. We would all go down to the pool room and listen to the Grand Ole Opera on the Crosley radio on Saturday night. And this was in the late 20s, early 30s. And of course, when Prohibition was repealed, and they, I'm always intrigued by these Sterling beer things on the radio, the commercials on the radio, and because that was the beer they had. That was not too far from Evansville, and they had Sterling beer in Ellie Kelly's pool room. Of course, everybody got drunk, my daddy included. And Then the Depression came along. I remember Black Friday, and it was October 1929 when that happened. And of course, people didn't realize then how serious it was. And I remember the headlines, stock market crash, and people were jumping out the windows and shooting themselves, and because people just lost a fortune overnight, millions of dollars. And they didn't have all the government protection back then that they had. The banks went busted all over the place. We had a little bank there at Drakesbury, and it went busted. I don't remember, just probably it went broke in about 1931, and people lost their money. So anyway, they reincorporated and opened up again, and son of a gun, it wasn't too long, they went broke again. People who had reinvested lost all their money, and of course they had a lot of property, owned a lot of mortgages, and they paid the people off that they could with property, homes and things like that.
What was it like for your family? Was it real tough?
Oh my goodness, you can't imagine. You simply cannot imagine. I've missed a lot of meals. I know what it is to be hungry. We missed a lot of meals. We moved to the country. My daddy was sort of a boomer. He was always traveling, and when the Depression hit, we had six children. I think my last sister was born in about 1930, I think. And there was three boys and three girls, and my mother. My mother was a little bitty thing. She weighed about 90 pounds at that time. And of course, back then, you know, women had to wash on the washboard and have washers and all that stuff. And my mother had to get up before daylight in the morning and build a fire in an old coal stove. Had a water tank on one end, didn't have running water. Break the ice in the kitchen in a bucket of water. We got the water from well, no running water. No indoor sanitary facilities. Outdoor toilets and all that stuff. And she would have to get up in the morning and fix breakfast for all of us, and then wash an iron by hand, heat those irons on an old coal stove, and wash outside and boil the clothes out in a big cast iron boiler. And people talk about, women were nothing. She was nothing more than a slave. And women back then didn't have too much rights. And that's the way it was, though. You know, mm-hmm. That's the way it always been. And she just worked herself to death. And my daddy was rather irresponsible, as I say, but she took care of her responsibilities. But by the time she was 65, she was just worn out. And she did live to be 77 years old before she died. Of course, daddy was gone part of the time, and many a time the thing just broke my heart. Our stockings were empty on Christmas. Sometimes my daddy would send us some money when he was out of town. Sometimes he wouldn't. As I say, he was rather irresponsible. He should never have been married in the first place. And in the second place, he should never have had six children.
Yeah.
I was the oldest one. And back then, the oldest son, you know, was supposed to work and help take care of the others. So I did. Boy, I dug ditches and I pushed wheelbarrows when I was 12 years old. This was in 1927, the first north-south highway that went through Muhlenberg County. Before that time, the roads were all dirt. In the wintertime, they were impassable. The only way to get any place was by train back then. Of course, we did have the LDN Railroad ran from Russellville up to Owensboro through Muhlenberg County there. At one time, they ran four passenger trains a day on that little 30-mile short line there. And the only way, they had a cattle pen downtown there. The people shipped their cattle by train and just about everything. I mean, I know a lot of times when we moved, we would ship our furniture by boxcar. You didn't have no superhighways. You didn't even have unsuperhighways really back then. And what was I going to say?
How did you hear about the CCC?
Oh, well, as I say, I finally got. I worked as a. I was going to tell you about the highway.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that they needed a water boy, and I got a job as a water boy. I didn't have the coolers and all that stuff back then, and I got a job as a water boy, It must have been one of the last construction crews that used mules and dump wagons. They used four team mules. Huge, great big mules. My goodness, their ears looked like they were that long. And these old dump wagons. And boy, that was a tough bunch. They called them mule skinners. I don't know if you ever heard that term or not. That's what they called people back then that drove mules and horse teams. Called them mule skinners. And some of them were black from down south. And I remember one black guy especially, he had one eye out. One of his eyes was white. And they were tough. And I was 12 years old at that time, so I carried water, I guess, for a couple of months during the summer. and bought my own school books. I think it was in about seventh grade then. You had to buy your own books. Hot meals and all that stuff. Who ever heard of hot meals? When I was 10 years old, I think we lived in Cave City, and I was going to school there. I think it was in third grade or something like that. And my mother would give me a nickel, and I would stop at a little grocery store downtown and get a nickel's worth of pickled bologna and crackers. And that was all I got. And people never heard of hot meals for kids and their nutrition and all that stuff. I think in a way it was a blessing in disguise because people back then, you didn't see too many fat people. You see a lot now.
Yeah.
Nearly everybody's overweight. Well, my sister and I always remark, she's rather skinny herself, always remark about people that come in these restaurants. You know, I mean, most of them are huge. I feel like I live in the land of giants now. I'm rather small myself. I was about average height back in the late 30s, in the late 30s there. I think the average height for men was about 5'7". I was close to that. And I think I was 5'6 in my stocking feet back then. Now, the average height for men and women has increased by about 3 or 4 inches since that time. Now, people just get more to eat. That's what I did, get a better diet. But anyway, it was a blessing in disguise because people's arteries didn't get clogged up. All the rich foods that everyone has now. So I guess in a way it was, although I tell everyone I might have been larger if I'd have gotten more to eat. And I've been a heavy eater ever since. I don't know whether I'll ever get, I don't think I'll ever get caught up. I'm still a heavy eater and I don't gain much weight. A friend of mine is Dr. Furnish. He was at the University of Louisville, taught at the University of Louisville for years and years. He was a doctor and in World War I. And after he got out, he got a chance to get a job as a professor at U of L. So he gave up his MD practice and took that. And he always tells me, he said, "My," he said, "your metabolism must be something else." He said, "Boy, the way you eat and everything, and no bigger than you are." It was rough. And so back then, I worked on the WPA. We got on relief, of course, but you only got the staples. You got a bag of flour, and you got your flour, and you got potatoes and things like that. But the government wouldn't give you sugar. You had to work and buy your sugar yourself. But the staples, the flour and beans, you go to a certain store in town there in Drakesburg, was designated as Landrum's, Paul Landrum's store, grocery store, and it was designated as a government relief station. And you would go there every week or two or something, whatever, every week, I guess, and pick up your little bag of beans and a sack of flour. And I think probably potatoes, they gave you potatoes too. But you had to work and buy your sugar. So I got a job on WPA 2 or 3 days a week. I think it was $3 and something a day. Mm-hmm. And an ex-policeman there in town was the foreman. He was an older man. And we did everything by hand, you know. All the roads were dirt. And we used hand tools and wheelbarrows and things. And we would fill grade the thing for drainage and dig ditches along the sides, you know, for drainage and fill in the ruts and things like that in the road. $3 and something a day. So finally, you had to work if you had to had to have somebody, a member of the family. If you had an able-bodied member of the family that was old enough, you had to work. Mm-hmm. And of course, my daddy couldn't work because he was the head of the household, and he was a barber, as I say. So finally, when the CCCs came into existence, they decided that the people, you either had to join the CCC if you were young enough, right age and all, and if you were already on relief, or they cut off your leave. So I had to go. I didn't want to.
How were people selected in the area, or did they just tell you to go?
They just told you to go.
Really?
Yeah. They didn't draft you exactly, uh-huh. But you had to join, or else they would cut off your leave.
Oh, really? Did they have an application process, or did you just?
Yeah. As I recall. I don't remember where you put in. They had your name and all. I don't remember how you applied. But anyway, I remember we went to Greenville, which was the county seat of Muhlenberg County, and took our physical examination. Mm-hmm. They just gave you a rough physical to see if your hearing was all right. And I remember the smart aleck doctor that gave me mine. They would hold a watch out like that back then, you know, now all the sophisticated equipment they have now. And they would bring that watch towards your ear and say, "Let me know when you hear that," you know.
Yeah.
And that's that smart aleck doctor. He did that, you know, and I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I see there." He said, "I didn't even have it."
Oh.
He had it back there. Anyway, my hearing is good. It's still good. And still perfect. I can almost hear a pin drop across the street. My hearing is very sensitive. Sometimes I wish it wasn't, because outside noise is just driving me up the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to Greenville, took her physical, and I don't remember. Seemed to me like that was August, and then I joined in the fall in the CCCs. The first camp I was in was in Trigg County, in Cadiz, Kentucky.
Oh, how old were you when you first went in?
Oh gosh, when was that? 1935. I was 20.
20.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what did you do in Trigg County?
That was what they call a soil conservation. Mm-hmm. That was a farming area there. Oh, that was a beautiful place then too. Cadiz, Kentucky was. We would go out land that had been eroded, been cleared and eroded, and we would build dams and brush dams and things like that to keep slow the water down so it wouldn't finish washing the soil away, so the erosion would stop. I was there almost a year. We all went through there, went through Cadiz, and the commander there picked out the ones, he asked for the ones who had the high school education. And I think about six of us out of that group, it must have been 100, had a high school education. He said, you all step forward, and we all stepped out. And so they he kept us, and I want you all here. And they sent the rest. Some of them went way out west, Montana and Idaho and way out there. My brother was out there. He didn't go in with that, but some of them went way out west there. So I was really glad that I got to stay that close to home. So they kept us there because of our education. And then I was there about a year, and then I got transferred to Mammoth Cave National Park. I worked in the field there. I got transferred to Mammoth Cave National Park, and I worked in the field there for a while. As I say, we built trails and steps in the new entrance to Mammoth Cave there, mm-hmm. and fought forest fires and things like that. What a beautiful place that was. And I haven't been back there for years. All kinds of wildflowers, magnificent trees, and this. It was just beautiful country. I'm afraid it's all been ruined now. I'm afraid to go back there and look.
No, it's still beautiful.
Yeah, they keep expanding parking lots and things like that, and people and nature simply do not go together. The automobile was a wonderful invention, but it's ruining the whole country. People are so mobile now. We're poisoning everything. We have to clear trees and land for parking areas, superhighways. We're polluting the air. People are just so mobile now that we're able to go anywhere and destroy everything. We're destroying the whole country. That's what we're doing. And it's not only here, but America is probably the worst for exploiting the environment. I'm a rabid environmentalist because I see what we have done to the environment already. And it's fast disappearing, and it's not exactly selfish, because when the environment is gone, we're going to be gone too.
Yeah.
Without the environment, what would we do? You know, the cities are like a cancer. And I can remember when a lot of the streams on the outskirts of Louisville, you know, were pure and clear and full of fish and everything. There's not a stream in Jefferson County now that's not polluted. And that holds true for almost every place else, especially in coal mining areas. Most of the streams have been ruined.
So you were in camp number two, you said?
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, we were right near the new entrance to Mammoth Cave.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I remember one thing there. After we'd been there for a while, they of course they were always exploring and looking for entrance. So they discovered a cave. I guess it was part of the new entrance, back in the hills there somewhere, not too far away. And someone was poking around, and they found that the entrance to one of the caves there had been sealed. The land that it had dropped down, the entrance had been concealed over the years. So they got busy out there and dug all of the debris away from the entrance, and they went in there exploring. And when they got in there, they found an Indian in there. They used to go in there to get saltpeter mm-hmm. for the war paint. I think later on they used saltpeter for gunpowder in the War of 1812, and
yeah.
Even after that, probably Revolutionary War too. I doubt if they were over there, but Revolutionary War of 1812. And they found he had been chipping this saltpeter from a huge boulder up over him, and apparently he had been squatting down almost right under that thing, and it fell on him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was all doubled up like this when they found him, and he was well preserved because it had been so dry, and there was not much air in there. And they got him out of there and put him on display over at the new entrance hotel there. I don't know if he's still there or not. Everybody called him Indian Joe.
Yeah.
Is he there? Well, they found him while I was there.
Yeah, I think one man I talked to had to guard him. His dad had to guard him overnight.
Yeah.
He's not there anymore. They put him back. The Indian people around didn't particularly like him on display, so he's back in the cave somewhere.
Oh, really? Well, for goodness sakes. Huh. Well, that's weird. yeah, and it looked like his mouth was open, you know, and he yelled, I guess, with that fellow.
Yeah.
And of course, it crushed him. He may have died slowly, though, because it was sort of on his hips here, his lower part. He may have laid there and suffered a lot before he finally died.
Well, tell me how you were paid.
Oh, we were paid by the month. You got $30 a month, a recruit. You got $30 a month, and you got to keep a whole $5 yourself. And send 25 home for the family. You had to do that.
How did you spend your $5?
Well, on movies, and of course back then I smoked cigarettes. They had a canteen. You could buy stuff in the canteen, candy bars and nickel. Cigarettes were a nickel a package. You didn't have to pay taxes on them because it was a government post. Back then you didn't have to pay in the Army post and government post. When I was aboard ship in the Navy, you didn't have to pay that tax. I think we got it for 10 cents a package when I was in the Navy. And go to a movie. I forget what the fare was at the movie in Cave City there. Some of the old movies. I remember seeing one of the movies I saw was Martha Ray was in it. And I forget the name of it, when she was very young. I'm sure you know who she is, the big mouth. And she was a great singer back then. One of those interplanetary movies. What's the guy's name that used to be in the old movies, the rockets and all that stuff? I always kind of went for that because I used to read wonder stories and amazing stories, and they were always about interplanetary travel. And people said, oh, you're crazy for that stuff. You know, they ain't never going to the moon. And I said, I bet you they do someday. I never realized that I would live to see it.
Yeah.
But I didn't do that stuff. And they were so realistic, those rocket movies, you know. Oh, you're going to Mars and the moon and all that stuff. I think my first talkie movie I saw was in Central City, Kentucky, in Muhlenberg County. That was the only place around it had talking pictures. They were still showing the old silent films in Drakesburg. The first movie I saw was the Gold Diggers of 1933 with Ginger Rogers. I think she was about 18 years old when she made that movie. And I forget who else was in that. Dick Powell and Joan Blondell, I think, was in it. And I forget who else. But anyway, those are the two most outstanding ones. Well, Ginger Rogers always one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah.
Her and Fred Astaire, especially dancing. I guess I've seen just about every one of their movies from the first ones to the last ones that they made together. They're always my favorites. The old movies I liked, always liked, of course, back when I was a kid, Tom Mix and Hoot Gibson and Buck Jones and all those, you know, the cowboys. I loved westerns when I was a kid. I'd always run around riding a broomstick and having a little cap pistol shooting in.
You were telling me that you worked a little bit with the near entrance of the cave. What other kinds of work did you do while you were in the CCC?
Oh, yes, I forgot. I finally ended up, I got a job in the kitchen washing dishes. Well, back then you washed dishes by hand, too. You didn't have frozen foods and all that stuff. You made your food from scratch. And I got a job in the kitchen. I finally worked my way up, and I got a chance to at second cook, so I ended up being a cook in the kitchen. I was second cook in the kitchen. Your second rating, I was a cook, second cook, that paid $36 a month.
Oh.
So I got a whole $11. And the first cook, and a sergeant, and that kind of thing, a leader they called him, they got $45 a month. It's like, sort of like a sergeant, young boy, that's a lot of money. They got a whole $20 for themselves, send $30 home. So I was doing all right there.
Yeah.
$11 a month. $11 back then would go a long way. Because back then, if you were poor, you didn't have an automobile. You didn't have air. Well, people never heard of air conditioning. And most of the time, when I was a child and when I was younger, we didn't even have an electric fan because half, two-thirds of the time we lived in homes that didn't have electricity. Mm-hmm. You had to do everything by by hand. And I know when you used to go to church and funeral parties and places like that, you know, they would have these little cardboard fans with a little wooden handle on them, you know, and had commercials on them. And same way in the movies. You go to the movies there. I remember the movie that was in Drakesburg when I was a child. This is way back in the 20s now, in the early 30s. Was way up on the third floor in a big old rickety frame building. And
Let me touch the tape real fast, so hold the thought.
Yeah.
This is the second side of my tape with Mr. James Ashby. Go on with your story. Sorry to interrupt.
And, they was way up on the third floor of an old rickety building there. There was a drugstore on the first floor and Saul West's general store on the first floor. The movie, as I recall, it was way upstairs and it was on the third floor. And this was an old rickety frame building. They never had no fire escapes. If they never had a fire in there, and everybody up there would probably burn to death, especially if it broke out between there and the ground, a little narrow stairway going, wooden stairway going upstairs. And well, back then in the old silent movies, they had player pianos were very popular back then, and they would play mood music in the film, you know, like the westerns and things like that. They would play make the noise of the horses' hoofs and that kind of thing. I remember my uncle and them had a player piano, and always loved those things. But they would have some young lady, she would usually come in and play the piano. Now there at Cave City, this was before I went to CC's. I lived in Cave City, by the way, before when I was about 10, 11 years old. And then later on, in about 10, 11 years later, when I about 20, I moved back to and went to Mammoth Cave National Park there. But my family didn't live in Cave City. In that movie, there's a lady who owned the movie there. It was right across the railroad tracks. There was a little park downtown and the train station there, and that was on the main line of the L&M. And there was a little park there between that street that ran right along the tracks and the railroad there. And a lady operated that movie house. But you had to have two projectors, you know. You cut one off. The film came in two rolls, two reels to a roll. And you would have to stop and cut in. You had to have two projectors, and you would stop one projector when the roll was exhausted and cut the other one on. You had to do it just right so it wouldn't cut off. Well, she only had one projector, and at the end of every two reels, they would have to stop the projector and rewind the film off of there and put the other two reels on. Oh, yeah. And she had some of us kids there, the boys, and we would, she let us, she got us to play the piano, and we got into the movie free. We would play the piano. She would pick out the music she wanted us to play. And she had really had a sophisticated player piano there because it had all these different sounds on it. Ordinary players did not. You just played the music. But she had, the horse and hoofs and the drums and all this stuff on this this fancy thing. And she would let us in to play the piano there. I was always fascinated by trains, and that was on the main line of the L&N. And of course, I lived there. I used to love to watch the trains go through. Those fast passenger trains, the Limiteds, the Pan American, and the Dixie Flyer, and all those. And they would just zoom right on through Cave City. And boy, the dust would swirl and everything. They didn't have any gates there. There was the main street crossed the railroad tracks there. There was a freight station right on this side. And then right on the other side, there was the loading platform, and the passenger station was over there. And I remember one day, especially this stands out in my mind, because I always, we lived right up on the hill behind the depot there in Cave City. And I always loved to watch the trains go through, and any time I could hear one coming, I would run down to the station. I had me a little coaster wagon. So one day, I heard the train coming, and all of a sudden it got down the track there about a mile or so, because they came through there doing about 60 with those big heavy steel passenger cars and those steam locomotives. Took a while for them to stop. And they had stopped down there, and I thought, oh my goodness, I wonder what's happened. And there's a water spout right there where you cross at the end of the station platform there that goes over towards the town and to the park there. And I started to run across there in my little wagon, and I looked down, and here was this guy, the young man. He had He was in a T-model Ford dump truck. Looked like almost a brand new T-model Ford dump. Still had the paint, still looked new, and I don't know if it had been used or not. And he had been coming from town, and evidently he couldn't see that train. Just had cross arms, no crossing gates, no flashing lights, nothing. And he didn't see that train coming or didn't hear it. And I don't think the car was closed, because most cars back then were open, you know. But anyway, he pulled up in front of that Dixie Flyer, and that big steam engine hit him, and boy, it just tore that car all to pieces. And he was lying there with a great big hole in his head. I will never forget that as long as I live. Yeah. And his lunch was wrapped in a piece of newspaper, and I remember he had an apple and a sandwich in it, and his lunch was laying over here wrapped up in a piece of newspaper, and he was lying there dead. I bought off the postcard. I'm telling you.
Let's see, when you were cook, tell me what your jobs were as cook.
Well, we had to prepare the meals. I think we had, around 140 men or something like that usually. And of course, back then you had canned foods, but no frozen foods and all that stuff. We had to make our own pies, our own cobblers, peel the potatoes. We did eventually get a potato peeling machine, electric potato peeling machine. I think it was just rolling around in there and rub the abrasive in there, and would rub the peeling off. We did eventually get one. Then before that, we peeled potatoes by hand. Usually one of the kitchen workers did that. But then we would cut them up and cook them and mash them and whatever. Fried potatoes or mashed potatoes. We had to make our own pie, made our own pie crust by hand. And all that for 140 men.
How many people were working in the kitchen?
Well, we had two cooks on duty at the time. Three or four, I think, we had. Of course, they had to mop the floors and wash the dishes, those big pots and pans. You did all, as I say, you did all by hand.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of schedule did you have?
Of course, the cooks had to get up well before daylight, mm-hmm. because the men had to, I forget what time they ate. Must have been 7 or 8 o'clock, something like that, before they had to get out in the field mm-hmm. and work all day. They would come in for, I don't remember if we came in for lunch or not. I think maybe they may have. I don't remember if I had lunch. I just don't remember. I don't think we had lunch in the field, but I don't remember how we did that lunch. But it was good food. As I say, when I joined the CCs, I was hungry, and boy, did I ever eat. I had never had such rich food in my life, and potatoes and gravy and all that stuff. Of course, back then, you know, everything you cooked was with lard. Mm-hmm. People holler about cholesterol and all that stuff, but people didn't know about that back then and pay attention to it. I don't know if it's really that bad or not, mm-hmm. as bad as they say it is, because my daddy lived to be almost 85. He was going to almost 85 when he died, and he never watched his diet. He drank barrels of coffee, would eat red-eye gravy. You know, you make red-eye gravy from ham, and you put coffee in there, call that red-eye gravy. He ate that stuff, and a lot of times the only thing we would have for breakfast when I was at home would be biscuits and gravy. Mm-hmm. Many a time. We didn't have bacon and eggs and all that stuff. That was pure luxury. And fruit juices and that kind of thing. Who ever heard of such thing? Only rich people had orange juice back then. It was a good wholesome diet. It was sort of the three C's you had to. They did have regimentation to a degree. They ran it something like the army, but not exactly. You didn't have the drill with guns and all this stuff, but you did have to line up and for roll call and salute when they raised the flag and all this stuff. As I say, they usually had some retired army captain. I remember especially one. The captain that was in Trigg County, awful nice fella, World War I veteran. I think he was probably retired, and he must have been in his 50s or 60s. And he had a lovely wife. Gosh, I always thought she was, everybody in camp was attracted to her because she was so pretty, and she's about 20 years younger than he was. And she was a good looking woman. He was awful nice guy. I remember one time they sent two checks to my home there in Central City, I don't know how come they found out about it. He asked me to come in and sign up for a check or something, and I did. I didn't know what they were doing, and they sent another check home. And then they come to find out that they had sent two checks. And so he said, well, I said, they probably done spent part of it. And he said, well, could you have them to send it to me? He said, I'll tell you what. He said, well, this must have been on the weekend. He said, we'll just, my wife and I, and we'll just drive up to Central City and get the money, what money's left. So so they did. It wasn't all, so they deducted that from the next check.
Mm-hmm.
But he was awfully nice. That's quite an experience for me, huh? Mm-hmm. Because not many people back then had automobiles, as I say. And if you were poor, you didn't have an automobile. You didn't have your own home. You rented, and a lot of people rented furnished apartments. And you especially didn't have two or three automobiles and your own home in the city and a camp in the country and all that stuff. People nowadays, our affluence is killing us. And as I say, I'm a dinosaur. I just can't see all that stuff. Khrushchev said that, you know, that he would bury us. I tell everyone, he won't have to bury us. We're burying ourselves with our love of money. Our love of affluence is killing us.
Well, let's see. How long did you work as a cook?
Oh, gosh, I guess I was there about a year or so. I shouldn't have come out when I did, but this fellow Steve Keelan and I, we decided that we were going to leave, and he said, well, I'll get a discharge if you will. I had been in about 28 months, I think, at that time. And in the meantime, the family had moved to Louisville. They moved here in 1936, mm-hmm. And they got in late 36. They got here in time for the 37 flood.
Yes.
And they lived in a furnished apartment down on Chester Street, not too far from a general hospital down here, the old general hospital, and the water got all around there. Daddy couldn't go to work. And as I say, my father was irresponsible, and he didn't get out and hustle, and we got no relief assistance at all. The Red Cross, you know, helped some people, but we never got help from anybody, the city or anybody. We had to do it on our own. My mother would go over to general hospital and get leftover food during the flood. And that's the only thing that kept us from starving to death, I guess. Candlelight. I had candlelight. Electricity was off, of course. No gas. Nothing. And it was rather cold back then.
So
I got a job. I got discharged, and I think it was October 38 mm-hmm. when I came out. And came back to Louisville. Of course, there wasn't much going on here either. You couldn't get a job here. And it was strange to me. I'd never been never lived in a big city before. A country boy. I guess it was a year or two before I did get a job. My younger brother, the one next to me, my oldest younger brother, was working for an old paper hanger at the time. He was paste boy for old paper hangers. I say back then you had to do everything you said, and everything wasn't prepared. You'd buy your paste and when you were papering and paste the paper and measure it and trim it and all that stuff. And that's what he did, and he would carry it. The paper hanger would tell him the measures, and he would paste it and keep the paste, mix up paste when he needed it, and he would paste the paper and trim it and then cut it to the proper size in case he was at a corner or something like that. So anyway, I finally ended up getting his job. That was a dollar and a half a day. I never will forget him, Mr. Waltney, but he could do almost anything. He was a carpenter, pretty good carpenter, a good paper hanger. He could do a little plumbing work. He's sort of a jack of all trades. He would do anything to make a dollar. But of course, he didn't make much. Mm-hmm. And things back then were so cheap, and wages were so cheap too that he didn't make much. He'd get hard up once in a while. I think when I finally quit, he still owed me about $7, I think it was. And he got married, and I never did get my $7. I took all his money to get married. And I worked at that for a while, and then I got a job as a painter. Got some contractor way out here on Bardstown Road somewhere. A friend of mine told me about it, and I got a job as an apprentice painter, non-union. 25 cents an hour. That's more unheard of money. I'd never made that much money in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And got a job with them and worked for them for a year or so. And finally got a nickel raise. I was making 30 cents an hour. I was still an apprentice. And then at that time they were building the powder plant across the river at Charleston. And gosh, there was thousands of people working there. They came here from all over the country, craftsmen from all over the country there. So I heard that my uncle, who was staying here with us at that time, Uncle Jesse Lee Ashby, said that he heard they were hiring painters over there. and got hired through the unemployment agency. I went down and put in my application, and they sent a bunch of us over there, and you had to take an examination. And so I passed and got a job over there. That was, they were paying union scale then, although then you didn't have to belong to union to work on a government job. Open shop, they called it, but they always did pay union scale, the government did back then. $1.125 an hour. And oh my goodness, I was, that was just unheard of. I'd never seen that much money in life. And back then, it didn't deduct too much from your wages. A small amount for Social Security and income taxes and things like that. It was nothing to compare to what it is now. Mm-hmm. I was drawing, but gosh, I think about $65 a week or something like that. Boy, that was wild. I worked over there, I guess, 6 months or so, and then got laid off there in October, November, I think, in 1941. And then Pearl Harbor came. I remember that Sunday morning I got up, and they had that on the radio about Pearl Harbor. I knew, boy, that was going to be it, because I wasn't married, had no children, no dependents, and no job. I was a good cannon fodder. They were looking for guys like me. So I joined then in January. Well, I went down and put in my application for the Navy. I thought, well, I do love to eat, and I thought, well, I'm going to join the Navy. And I get aboard ship, at least we'll have the kitchen with us. Mm-hmm. And I can always eat. Mm-hmm. So I joined the Navy. And back then, you had to pass a pretty rigorous physical to get in the Navy at that time, much more rigorous than it would be in the Army. Mm-hmm. They tested you for color blindness and all this kind of stuff. I think at that time, I was skin and bone, I'm telling you. I weighed 115 pounds stripped. I was jockey weight. Mm-hmm. I'd made a good jockey. And I thought, well, you know, I didn't think I'd ever pass anything. Passed it with flying colors. They took me right on in. My brother and I joined at the same time, my older friend, Raymond Lee. Mm-hmm. The one I told you had Lee in his name, Raymond Lee. And so they said, well, you go home and we will let you know. We'll send you to Great Lakes for your training. We'll let you know when. So that was in January, and in February we went to Great Lakes for our training there. And boy, it was cold up there.
Yeah.
Lordy, lordy. Oh, that was rough. You know, get out there and in the field and exercise. They were still using those old 1903 Springfield rifles. Those things weighed a ton. And we'd get out there and exercise with those. Go through the manual of arms and all that stuff. And jump up, you know, and stick that gun up in the air. And a lot of times it'd be snow on the ground and that cold wind coming off the lake. I like to froze to death. And at that time, you had to sleep in hammocks, and I never slept in a hammock in my life. They gave us all those shots, and I don't know what all shots, tetanus and typhoid, and oh my, gave them all to you at once. And I had a little reaction from that. Boy, I'd go to bed at night, and I would be feverish, and the cold chills would run up and down my back. I felt miserable. that was terrible. I'd take a blood test and all this stuff. There and I was there about I was stationed there at Chicago Great Lakes about we had to wait for a ship there, and they sent me over to what they call the outgoing unit after I took my boot training, and it's where they put everyone. And I stayed there. When did I leave there? It was the next September. They sent me to, I stayed there in the outgoing unit a while, and then they sent me to Philadelphia. I think they were building our ship. It was a fleet oiler, they called them, a Navy tanker. They were equipped to refuel at sea. We would rendezvous with battleships and destroyers and cruisers and things like that out at sea before they went into battle. And while we were underway, we refueled them. It was a ticklish operation, by the way. That's what this was, a Navy. I think they were building it when the war broke out for some oil company, and the government took it over and refitted it for Navy duty. And USS Patuxent was the name of it. So I got transferred to the outgoing unit to Philadelphia, and I waited there for my ship. It wasn't ready. They had to. So I think they got it ready, in November, December, or something like that. And I was there, I must have been there at Philadelphia for a couple of months or so. This was after I got out of boot camp. I don't remember what when I got out of boot camp, but it was several months before I finally went aboard a ship. But I stayed in Philadelphia there for a while. Oh, I loved Philadelphia at that time. Oh, what a marvelous city. The girls all like sailors. It was a sailor, Navy base there. And the Marines, especially the Marines and the sailors, had a base there. And the people there were so friendly and good to us. They called that the city of brotherly love. But it was back then. People were just so nice. I just enjoyed every minute of being in Philadelphia.
I need to get back to little CCC for a moment.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's interesting.
Got off on that.
That's okay. Well, I heard about your job and everything, and how much free time did you have, especially when you were a cook? Did you have much free time?
Let me see. We had certain shifts. You know, I don't remember how they arranged that, but we would be off and on for a while, you know. I don't remember whether it was on 2 or 3 days and then off 2 or 3 days or just how it was, but we would get a rest in between there.
Did you participate in any of the education or recreation programs that they had in CCC?
I don't think so. Of course, we had back then about the only regular sports we had was we had volleyball and tennis, baseball, and that kind of thing. I don't remember if we had a team or not. I don't think they did. Transportation back then, as I say, was bad. People were not nearly as mobile as they are now. And if you did get around, you got around a lot slower than you do now.
Did you take any classes? I know they had an education program. Did you ever take any of the classes that they offered?
Yes, I did, but I don't remember what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I joined the Navy, I got a job in the outgoing unit. The fellow in charge of the records department there let me work back there with him. He found out I had a high school education, and that was a big help to me there. He found out I had a high school education. We would look through the records and see who was gone and update the records every once in a while, see who was gone and who was still there and this kind of stuff. And someone would want to call in to see if someone was there. And they would send a telegram to people money, you know, so we had a desk there in the outgoing unit and telegram see who, telegram their sons or money or whatever they need, whatever there. And we would, I would call out over the PA system the names of those who had telegrams in the outgoing, at the outgoing unit office. I don't think they didn't have to. I was never a great athlete, never. I was very agile and I was fast for my size, and I was strong for my size. But I was not a Superman. I wasn't. I tell people I never was macho, but I've outlasted a lot of macho men. I wasn't muscular, but my body was just like steel. You know what there was of it, and that stood me in good stead. But I never was a great athlete. I didn't have endurance and all that stuff. Back then I smoked. And as I say, my diet had not been good, and I didn't have a lot of stamina. Still don't, for that matter, now. I had more later on. Of course, now at 73, I still don't, but I'm still in pretty good shape to be as old as I am.
What did you do with your free time then?
Well, a lot of times we would, sometimes there would be a carnival in town around Cave City or Glasgow. Not Cave City too often, it was too small, but once in a while there'd be a carnival over at Glasgow there in Barron County. And we would walk around through the park a lot of times. A couple of us would go out exploring in the woods. There's a lot of little caverns around there, you know. Almost every hillside would have a little cavern in it. You'd come, be walking through the woods, and you had to watch because sometimes you could step in those things. They went way down there, you know, it would go straight down. And we'd go out looking for those, and we would explore other caves. I remember a lot of times, there was one big cave there we went in one time. I forget where it was. You just walk into it. Anybody could have gotten in it. But, Lord, we walked in there, and and a big black cloud flew over our head, and that thing, there was millions of bats in that thing.
Oh, that would have been awful.
they hang from the ceilings, you know what I mean? Just like you see them in the movies.
They didn't like you coming in there.
Well, it alarmed them, you know. We would swim. Green River was right down at the foot of the hill there at the old Mammoth Cave, which wasn't too far away within walking distance. And a lot of times we would walk down there and swim and explore caves. And a lot of times we would walk over near the new entrance there, because a lot of times there would be busloads of kids coming there, you know, girls. And we'd walk over there. We'd walk, a lot of times they'd be walking down the road, you know. And we would walk over there and watch them, and watch a girl watching, and flirt and whistle at them. that was entertainment.
Did many of the boys date local girls?
Some did. Talmadge Fleming, as I say, he was a real good friend of mine. Now he lived in Powderly, Kentucky, which was about 3 miles between Central City and Bowling Green, about 3 miles, by coal mining camp. It wasn't much back then. The coal mines had already, I think, there were strip mines there had already closed down. But he introduced me to his. Niece. He had a niece there that lived in Powderly. And his sister and her father was dead. And I would go home with him to his family, because, as I say, my family was so poor, I couldn't take anybody home, because we wouldn't have any, couldn't feed them and that kind of thing. But his family, they were farm people, and they all lived together there in a frame house there in Powderly, and had nice shade trees in the yard and all that. And I guess they think they had their own chickens, maybe a cow and all that. And I would go home with him when we would get a leave on the weekend, something like that. We'd catch somebody driving down there who had a car, and we'd always make up a carload. And he introduced me to his niece, Helen Gossett was her name. And I used to go down and see her. He could get a girl anywhere. But as I say, he was an extremely handsome fellow. Had great, great big blue eyes. His hair was wavy. And he looked like a movie star, really. He used to make me so mad. All the girls would just flock to him, you know. They just act like I wasn't even there. But Talmadge was a nice guy. He was a nice guy. And he ended up marrying a little girl from down around, I think it was Cleeton, Kentucky. A little, she was almost fat, pimply-faced girl. She wasn't pretty at all. And nobody could ever figure out why he picked her of all people. I guess that's what love does for you. I guess he still got her.
Well, did the CCC boys play many pranks on each other?
Oh my goodness, yes. Oh, listen, a lot of those guys had records. You know, some of them were mean as a hornet, and always fighting and playing pranks on each other. Yes.
Do you remember any of the pranks?
Oh, goodness, I don't remember. I don't remember what. He used to do one thing. One thing I remember especially, they used to do what, I think they used to do this in the Army. They would short sheet people. I guess you've heard of that
one.
And then love it. A lot of times, then other times they would get drunk or something, you know, and come in and the guys would be in their bed and they'd turn the bed over and turn it right on top of them.
Oh, no.
they were rough.
Oh, no. Lord.
Yeah, this little guy, as I was telling you, Steve Keelan, boy, nobody messed with him. And he and I were pretty good buddies. He used to tell me something else. He said, Ashby, he said, I bet you if you and I got up in this ring, in the ring out here, and invited anybody to come up and take us on, he said, I bet you they wouldn't do it. I said, well, I hope you're right. I said, I ain't going to invite them.
Yeah.
he was mean. And I've seen him knock, he was only about my size, but he was very muscular. And much wider chest than I have. And as I say, he was an ex-boxer. And I've seen him knock a big guy weigh 200 pounds more and knock him flat and knock him cold as a cucumber. He was a man. Mm. I thought I was a pretty good man, but I tangled him a few times and I found out I wasn't.
Right.
I wasn't as good a man as he was. I was awfully strong for my size. I was above average, I guess you might say. But I was not a street fighter. A lot of those guys were street fighters, you know. They get in a fight with them, they're not going to fight you fair anyway. You know, they do anything to hit you below the belt or what, anything to get the best of you. Some of them just soon kill you as not, you know. Oh, they used to do other pranks, throw water through the window on people in their beds, you know, and stuff like that. Offhand, I can't remember any of the others, but those are two outstanding ones.
Well, was there much interaction among the different camps, you know, say 2, 3, and 4, you don't think?
No, there wasn't. As I remember, none. None whatever.
Okay.
I mean, they were all just more or less on their own. Isolated.
Now let me go ahead and get another tape in before I start with the next round. Mm-hmm.